Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Columbus health officials call it the worst hepatitis A outbreak in two decades. In a typical year, the city sees fewer than 10 cases. Already in 2019, 200 cases of this highly contagious liver infection have been reported. Joining us is spokeswoman for Columbus Public Health, Kelly Newman Myers. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And Population Health Division Administrator for Columbus Public Health. That's a mouthful. Luke Jacobs, welcome.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you.
Is this just about numbers of reported cases, or is the strain worse, or what, Luke?
It's really an increase in cases, and a lot of other states and communities have been dealing with this for the past couple of years throughout the United States. And, middle of 2018, we realized that, the surrounding states, Michigan, Kentucky, and West Virginia, were all kind of battling separately their own hepatitis A outbreaks, mainly tied to people experiencing homelessness and people using drugs and men who have sex with men. So, again, seeing that, we decided to try to get out in front of it as best we can in 2018 and provide some vaccination to those high-risk populations. And then we started seeing cases around June or July of 2018.
So you're saying it could have been worse?
Well, we're still in the middle of it. Yeah. So, I mean, it's really hard to tell how long we're going to see cases at the level that we're seeing it now, but we're taking every measure we can to, vaccinate people that are high at risk and make sure we're just encouraging people to wash their hands.
Yeah. And what most people are unfamiliar with the dangers of hepatitis A. What does it do?
So hepatitis A, if you're a healthy person, you can expect that you will feel bad. You'll start to have a headache, maybe a fever, have some general malaise. And then, the obvious symptoms are dark urine and then what everyone is familiar with, jaundice, which is the yellowing of the skin or the eyes. And so many people, I think about 60% of our cases locally have had some hospitalization. So that's a pretty high rate.
Is that because of who it tends to be hitting?
Perhaps at times, yes.
Already compromised people?
Right.
Okay.
So if you're healthy, you might feel bad and you might be down for a few days. But if you have some underlying health conditions, like with any infection, it's going to hit you a little bit harder.
And it attacks the liver. Does it do long-term damage?
You will recover. Most people do recover. You do have to typically let it run its course. Some people, that will put them in the hospital, but some people not. And some people may have it and not even know it. They may think, gosh, I wasn't feeling well. I think I have a bug or a touch of something. And they just recover on their own and they never know they had it.
But that's a problem because they can spread it.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. So that's why washing your hands is so important. Prevention in this outbreak and really any kind of infection like that that's highly contagious, that's why it's so important to wash your hands.
It's not just bloodborne then.
No, actually, hepatitis A is different than hepatitis B and hepatitis C in that it is spread through what we call in the public health world the fecal-oral route, which essentially is you have fecal matter contaminated on surfaces or hands, and then there's contact with that, and then there's contact with your mouth, inadvertent or not. So it's different than B and C in that the main mode of transmission is through this kind of fecal-oral route, and that's why, again, hand washing is just imperative.
Is that a big reason why employers say employees must wash hands?
Well, it's hepatitis A, and it's a dozen or two dozen other. And again, just washing your hands after you go to the restroom and before you eat are just the best practices that you can to avoid things getting into your mouth that aren't supposed to be there.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the hepatitis A outbreak in Columbus. That's Luke Jacobs. He's Population Health Division Administrator for Columbus Public Health. Also with us, Kelly Newman Myers. She's spokeswoman for Columbus Public Health. They've opened up clinics to not treat hepatitis A per se, but to inoculate against it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is a hepatitis A shot, vaccination, is it covered by most healthcare plans?
It is covered by most health insurance plans. And, it's readily available. That's the good news. So this outbreak and hepatitis A in general can be prevented. And so the shots are available, at your retail pharmacies. That's your Kroger, your Walgreens, CVS, that kind of thing. We have them available at our immunization clinic. So we do have regular hours that are posted on our website. Or your healthcare provider. Of course, that's usually the first place that people will go. But they are available. They're covered by insurance in most cases, and they're easy to get. So that's why we're encouraging specifically the people in the high-risk groups, but also then anybody who wants protection to really go to their provider, go to a retail outlet, just get the vaccine.
And I would just add that not only is it readily available, it's highly effective. It's a two-dose series for hepatitis A. After one dose, you're 93 to 95% protected from hepatitis A. At two doses, it's almost it nears 100%. So nothing's ever foolproof, but this is an easy way to ensure immunity from the specific disease.
I know you said that they had outbreaks in surrounding states. This wasn't unexpected. The city tried to prepare for it last year with increasing the immunization clinics. But why the outbreak in the first place? What's going on?
You know, I don't think the public health world fully understands why these outbreaks have occurred at the level that they are, but given that the populations that they're in, the homelessness population and the people using drugs being the main high-risk categories.
That's where you're finding it the most?
Yeah, I mean, bulk of our cases fit into one of those categories. But not every single one of them do. So this is spilling over to some extent into the larger population. But again, our efforts have been completely focused on continuing to provide vaccination to those populations. The one big one that we always refer back to is the San Diego outbreak back from 2014, 15, and even I think 16 to some extent.
What was that like?
Again, it was really focused around and centered around the homelessness population and people using drugs. And they finally got a hold of it after they vaccinated. You know, they had pretty large vaccination efforts to get it under control.
Does the anti-vac movement extend to things like the hepatitis A vaccination? Do we know?
Well, we haven't heard too much of that. I think that's always an issue, but I hope that
they connect it with the measles outbreak out in Oregon and Washington.
Right. And that, you know, when we have an outbreak like that, I think it's a great reminder to everyone of what happens when you don't vaccinate. You know, we can only be one airplane ride away from a measles case here. And so I think when we see these outbreaks pop up like we have out west, you know, it's a reminder. That's why you get your vaccines. That's why you get them in a timely manner, because it really protects not only you, but the entire community.
If you suspect hepatitis A, if you think that's what you might have, what should you do? Should you see a doctor and find out for sure?
Absolutely. If any time you feel that you feel ill like that, I mean, our best advice is to go see your physician and have them determine what may be causing it. A lot of times what leads people to the hospital, as Kelly alluded to, is kind of these dramatic symptoms, dark-colored urine, jaundice.
Right.
Those are pretty dramatic as opposed to the general, you know, vomiting, diarrhea you would get as well.
And then if you have hepatitis A, you're diagnosed with it, you have to stay home?
Yes. And so that's why you would stay home. And hopefully, again, that's for people who know they have it. You know, because you would prevent it from spreading to others. If you work in certain jobs, for example, food service, you're required to stay home.
Okay. And could, if I just work in the office, if somebody had it here at WOSU, could they pass it along?
It certainly is possible. I mean, again, it's more likely with close prolonged contact.
Gotcha.
But there is some. You know, some notion that the viruses can survive on surfaces for a period of time. So, again, I think just hand washing, cleaning, and vaccination are, you know, the most critical things to make sure that we prevent the spread.
And who is most at risk of being compromised by hepatitis A? You're saying healthy people, it's something you'll go through. You want to stay away from other people. But it sounds like if the bulk of the problem is among homeless and opioid addicted people, that's a pretty compromised group already, right?
Absolutely.
So they're getting very sick.
They are getting sick. And again, we also see people with chronic liver disease like hepatitis C or B. We'll see co-infections with hepatitis A because their liver is already trying to deal with those other infections. So we do see a fair amount of people with chronic liver disease that are coming down as hepatitis A cases too. So,
and children? Are any of them children?
Well, the good news is that the Hep A vaccine is recommended now for children. It has been since about 2006.
Okay.
It is not mandated or required for school
attendance
at this point.
In Ohio, that's the way
it is. Yes. But it is recommended. And so largely kids do have immunity that we as adults don't have.
If somebody goes to a clinic, do they have to pay for a vaccination?
One of our clinics?
Yeah.
No. Vaccination is free of charge.
Okay. And I read that you'd expanded the clinics.
We did. We held a couple of special clinics when we became aware of a couple of food service workers that had direct food contact. And in the course of our investigation, you know, we felt that there were, you know, risks to the public. We did put it out to the public and held a couple of special clinics. The most recent one was just yesterday.
Okay.
Or Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Mike in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Guys, I know you've been talking a lot about how hepatitis is passed around and immunizations and stuff, but my question was for little kids. So my kids, when they were babies, my oldest son received 3 hepatitis shots by the time he was about 8 weeks old. And looking back, why did he need so many shots at that age when later when I did my homework, I found out if you're not traveling outside the country, if you're not an intravenous drug user, if you're not, I mean, the list went on and on, mm-hmm. that a baby would not intel, and I'm curious why, if you guys could answer, why they're starting them so young with this.
Well, I mean, I'm not a healthcare provider, so, you know, I know it's part of the recommended vaccine series. You know, I know there's a lot of science behind that. I would hope that parents work with their healthcare providers and their child's pediatrician to really talk through the pros and cons of that vaccine and all childhood vaccines as far as addressing the particular recommendation, because I'm not, you know, a medical provider. I can't address that directly. But again, if you have questions, I think it's always best to talk to your pediatrician. They're a great resource, you know, for the pros and cons.
And I think just to add on that, you know, kids, and I have 4 children, so kids tend to not wash their hands very well. So I think as adults, we have more behavioral control.
They put their hands in their mouth a lot.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
so even though, you know, it seems like a lot, I mean, again, it's really trying to prevent things that can make children, especially because children are one of these populations of immunocompromised folks that that they really need protection from these diseases.
If they get it, then it's trouble.
Absolutely.
Right. And what? When are you looking for a peak in this?
You know, that's really hard telling. One of the challenges with hepatitis A or hepatitis in general is how long the period from exposure to being sick is. We call it the incubation period.
Do we know?
So we know that it's 15 to 50 days,
but
it averages around a month. So think about all the things you can be exposed to in a month's period of time. So these are very hard to investigate. But again, we won't know until a few months after whether or not we've kind of quote peaked or whether or not this is starting to come down.
Does it have anything to do with weather?
I don't think there's any science out there that supports that it's weather related. I mean, I think, again, what we have been focusing on, you know, the population that uses drugs and the population that are experiencing homelessness, because right now with being cold outside, we have sort of a more captive audience in terms of being able to provide them vaccinations at like soup kitchens and shelters and things like that. So,
right. And are people availing themselves of this?
Yeah,
those places.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're getting a good kind of uptick in the vaccination being taken when we have, especially when we have a case within a facility. We provide vaccination to all those that either work there or have been exposed. So
at that restaurant that had the 2 employees, you went right to the restaurant and vaccinated everybody.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have been very proactive in our approach. You know, as public health, this is what we do. We do disease surveillance and we do prevention. And so we have been going out to these high-risk groups. So we're kind of going where they are, knowing that this is an issue in the community and really providing those vaccines, you know, and taking them the education, too, letting them know, you know, how they can prevent it and offering that vaccine. So I know we've been very proactive since really last summer, and we'll continue to do so.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Kelly Newman-Myers, for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you, Ann.
Kelly Newman-Myers, she's spokeswoman for Columbus Public Health. And Luke Jacobs, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Ann. Thank you.
Luke Jacobs, he's Population Health Division Administrator, who needs a new title for Columbus Public Health. That's it for this. We will be right back with more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Racial disparity in quality health care still exists in the United States, and African Americans are getting the short end of the stick, and that gap includes end-of-life care. Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Howard University, Yolanda Wilson, recently wrote about the issue for The Conversation. We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Yolanda Wilson joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
You wrote about this in terms of your own father who died recently, and I'm very sorry for your loss. Tell us what happened.
Thank you. So, yeah, it was actually back in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
But my father had diabetes and had complications from that. But what eventually killed him was, you know, an infection of unknown origin that physicians just couldn't figure out what exactly it was or how to treat it, and he was on broad-spectrum antibiotics. But the thing that struck me was the difficulty in managing his pain. And there were moments when I thought that his medical team was not as proactive about that as I felt they should have been and could have been.
What do we know about how, you know, the healthcare industry responds differently to people who are African American versus whites?
Well, specifically in the realm of pain management, there's really good data about gaps in taking pain complaints seriously and also treating pain of Black patients. And some of that is attributed to kind of false racial beliefs, for instance, the belief that Black people have thicker skin. And we see that not just in end-of-life care, but we see that across the lifespan. So even when you see Black children coming into the emergency room with bone fractures, for instance, they're not given the same degree of pain management or opioids that white children are given. And so, you know, that just becomes one more aspect of disparity for Black patients.
You wrote that Black patients generally receive worse pain management. What do you mean by that? Mm-hmm. A lack of any management at all? Is it more about what drugs they're getting, or more about how healthcare professionals respond to their pain?
So it's both, actually. So, you know, initially it is how healthcare professionals respond to pain complaints. And we also see this in white women, right, that pain complaints are not taken as seriously. The assumption, sometimes implicit, I'll even say often implicit, that, you know, Black patients are overreacting leads to, again, discounting those kinds of symptoms or indication of pain.
Where does that
but
come
even
from?
When pain is,
well, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was going to say, even when pain is treated, we do look at different kinds of drugs, and Black patients are less likely to get the kind of strong opioids and such.
What are the attitudes that are informing healthcare professionals when it comes to that?
Mm-hmm.
Why do they treat them differently?
Yeah. So again, I don't want to assume malice. Right. I mean, there may be malice operating in at least some instances, but often it is kind of misperceptions of Black pain. There is kind of floating around in the medical literature some belief that Black people don't experience pain in the same ways that white patients experience pain. The beliefs that physiologically Black people just have thicker skin and therefore we don't feel pain in the same ways. And so there's a lot of kind of misinformation and misunderstanding about what race is, and a lot of attributing physiological characteristics to race that are not actually accurate. So
but,
there's that.
And doctors and nurses are science people.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any policies that you endorse that would address these attitudes?
Yeah, so what we're seeing certainly in healthcare education in recent years is, you know, kind of conscious, intentional moments in the curriculum where there are conversations about cultural competence and implicit bias and trying to overcome those false beliefs. But there's actually one study where medical students actually do believe that Black people are just physiologically different.
Just flies in the face of logic and how frustrating. I mean, what you wrote about 57-year-old Barbara Dawson and her experience, what happened with her?
Mm-hmm. So she was experiencing pain. And so she was in a hospital outside of Tallahassee, Florida, and this was December 2015. She was experiencing pain, and she had been in the ER, and apparently she had had some treatment. And she continued to complain and said that, you know, she was still having difficulty breathing. And the hospital staff eventually called the police on her because she refused to leave. Right. She refused to leave without being treated. And so by the time the police arrived to arrest her, she collapsed before they could get her into the cruiser. And even initially, it seems that the arresting officer thought that she was faking. And it took a couple minutes to realize, oh, no, this woman is actually unconscious. And she was kind of rushed back into the hospital. And she later died within an hour or so of an undetected blood clot in her lungs. And so I kind of gave that example just to show, you know, look, you know, it's not obvious, you know, none of us has a crystal ball. So we mm-hmm. don't know if she was actually, you know, if she would have lived had she gotten treatment. However, just the kind of callous way that she was handled and that her pain and her other kinds of symptom complaints weren't taken seriously is the point that I wanted to highlight mm-hmm. in this particular piece.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Yolanda Wilson, assistant professor of philosophy at Howard University. And she recently wrote about for The Conversation about how Black people are treated differently when it comes to pain management, including at end of life. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Have you had an experience you want to share? We would like to hear it. How about end of life wishes, Yolanda Wilson? What did you see there?
So it turns out that African-American patients are less likely to die in hospice and are less likely to have advanced directives. And so we know that just in general in the United States, we're not great at end-of-life planning. Not as many of us have had those conversations with our friends and family as perhaps we should have, which leads to, you know, complicated feelings on behalf of caregivers at the end of life.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, leaving others to make those really difficult decisions and trying really hard to think about what we would have wanted. But we see that the numbers are even worse for African-American patients. And so what I think that just generally we need to have more conversations in this country about what our end-of-life wishes are, because, you know, the bottom line is we are all going to die at some point, right? I mean, that is inevitable.
Yeah, none of us get out of here alive.
Well, That's right.
What do you know about why that African-Americans are even less likely than the general population to die in hospice and to have end-of-life directives? Why is that?
Well, so there are a lot of complicated reasons for that. You know, some of that is just access to medical care generally, right? So most people who have advanced directives have them because they've had these conversations with their physicians. You know, they have a physician who tracks them and who provides much of their health care. And we see African Americans often don't have that kind of consistent, continued access to health care to even have these conversations with a healthcare provider who knows us and can initiate those conversations and understand our wishes.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of that is we tend to just die sicker. We die sooner and we die sicker. And so we're more likely to be in ICUs for intensive care units for some, you know, sustained period of time and not, you know, once again, even have the opportunity to switch to hospice or have those kinds of hospice conversations.
I want to turn to Oh, I guess we don't have a call yet. And what you wrote about a study that found physicians interact less, both verbally and nonverbally, with Black patients who are dying than with white patients who are dying. How do we know that? What was that study about?
Okay, so that study actually measured interaction by things like eye contact and hand-holding and those other kinds of nonverbal cues with patients. So it was a randomized study. 33 physicians in Pennsylvania participated. And so scorers were able to kind of score verbal communication. And, you know, of course, they have these metrics in order to try to control for variables and such. And so, yeah, it turns out that at least among the physicians in this study, that the physicians indicated fewer interactions with dying patients who were Black.
Which you, the posit being that it affects how they're treated when it comes to pain management.
So, yeah. You know, that kind of comfort care at the end of life, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that just kind of basic human touch, human interaction. And I think it also has an effect on kind of families and loved ones who are observing this, right? You might not know that your physician is interacting with you more than other patients or less than other patients. But mm-hmm. I also think, you know, people aren't crazy. You can sense when someone is, you know, attentive and sensitive and when others aren't. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that also contributes to the distress that families sometimes feel around the death and dying of their loved ones.
I'm turning to Cirilla in Columbus. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I actually wanted to share two things. So one, actually, there was a study a couple years back. I remember reading it like while sitting in a hospital room. It was either, I don't know if it was specifically Chicago, but at least Illinois, and they looked at that. And, you know, I had always just thought about that. I'm a social worker. So I had always just thought about that. And I said, I think part of it has to do with, like, you know, access. A lot of, like, you know, the stereotype, Black people are, you know, more in poverty, so therefore they may have less access to health care, mm-hmm. less access to health insurance, so therefore they're probably mm-hmm. not going to the hospital right when, you know, they're having the symptoms, and it's when the pain becomes mm-hmm. super, mm-hmm. super unbearable. Finally, they're reaching, they're getting treatment, so that's why there's mm-hmm. a misconception that that's why they have a higher pain tolerance, because they didn't go to the hospital, you know, when mm-hmm. maybe someone did have health insurance would have went immediately. So that's one thing. Mm-hmm. And then, sorry, my personal experience, I'm a type 1 diabetic. I've been diabetic since I was mm-hmm. like, diagnosed when I was 15. I actually was experiencing mm-hmm. symptoms for about 4 or 5 months before I was diagnosed. Went to the hospital probably every 2 or 3 weeks, complaining of a stomach mm-hmm. ache. To me, that was what it was. It was a big stomach ache. I would throw up immediately when I ate. And basically, I was in DKA, mm-hmm. ketoacidosis, for about 4 or 5 months. And they're dismissing my symptoms. Oh, it's a flu. Oh, it's a stomach bug. Oh, mm-hmm. it's, they actually thought I was anorexic because I was in ninth grade at the time. They're like, oh, the pressures of being in high school or something. You know what I mean? I just want to like mm-hmm. fit in with the other kids. Mm-hmm. Whereas like I have friends who are also type 1 diabetics. And, you know, we all talk about it, you know, when we got diagnosed. And none of them had the same experience. Within a couple of weeks, within a month, they were diagnosed. And the majority of them are white, you know, and actually males, because I thought maybe there's a intersectionality between gender and race, mm-hmm. you know, because it finally was a Black nurse who was able to diagnose me. She, like, you know, just looked at my symptoms and was like, what? Took a finger stick of me and then immediately sent me to the emergency room, and I spent a week in there learning how to give myself mm-hmm. insulin, you know, as opposed to for 4 or 5 months, I'm going to the hospital, going to ER, going to see different doctors, and they're just sending me home with Tylenol.
Wow.
So.
Does that sound familiar, Yolanda Wilson?
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for your call. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, on both counts. Absolutely. So yeah, this idea that we don't have access to health care in the same ways becomes a, you know, that's a significant barrier to mm-hmm. seeking treatment. And then we know that if we seek out treatment and we don't feel that we're respected or heard, then we're less likely to come back. But to just kind of add a little bit to that point, we know that that's what the data show. But also, if you control for insurance status, we still don't get the same mm-hmm. kinds of of treatments. And so what you see, particularly that's been very prevalent in the media in the last year or two, is about Black women and our maternal fetal health outcomes.
Right.
That we are more likely to die due to pregnancy complications or right after childbirth. And that happens across socioeconomic class. And in fact, I have a paper that literally just came out today where we talk about this issue that, you know, across many dimensions of health, the highest socioeconomic status Black women still have worse health outcomes than the poorest white women in the U.S. You know, that's how dramatic the difference is in terms of our health outcomes.
So,
and then for the second, oh, go ahead.
You go ahead.
No, I was going to say for the second point about, you know, having to go back and to go back repeatedly and to be sent home with Tylenol. Actually, that's what happened to my father. And, you know, there's a part of me that still wonders, you know, had his physicians taken him more seriously and looked more carefully for this infection, could it have been caught? I don't know. But that is something that I think about periodically, you know, that some of our health outcomes are attributable to not being taken seriously and having to come back repeatedly, or not being taken seriously and then just going, you know, forget it and just not coming back at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that we tend to have slightly better health outcomes when we have Black health providers, that they tend to take our complaints a little bit more seriously. As the caller just said, it was a Black nurse who, after several months of just being sent home with Tylenol and dismissed, looked at her and decided to pursue it further.
How do you think we resolve these things if we rule out, if we rule out people doing it on purpose? So it's unconscious,
right.
Subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
How do you address this kind of a problem?
Yeah, so, you know, this is a hard one too, because in order to address it, then people have to be willing to concede that maybe we don't treat all patients the same. And that, you know, goes against what most people like to think of themselves. You know, we all like to think of, well, I won't say we all, but many of us like to think of ourselves as good people who treat everyone fairly and who take everyone, you know, seriously in the same way. And certainly healthcare providers like to think that about themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're no different. And so, you know, the first part of that is to really be willing to sit with the discomfort of that reality. I mean, study after study shows it. And so it can't just be abstract. This is literally happening on the ground across hospitals across the country. And so the first step has to be a willingness to really sit with this discomfort in finding that out and being honest about that and how that plays out. And then we can start talking about kind of implicit bias interactions and being more mindful of what our interactions are, and maybe even being more, if we have to be, being more intentional about checklists and checking symptoms, for example.
Right. Protocols.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Yolanda Wilson, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yolanda Wilson is an assistant professor of philosophy at Howard University. She recently wrote about disparities and how African-Americans are treated, or anyone who's Black is treated in healthcare. There are disparities when it comes to treatments at end of life, treatments for pain. We'll have a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll continue with Wellness Wednesday when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Many choose organic food at the grocery in part to reduce the risk of cancer and other ailments. A new study finds that going organic might reduce cancer risk, sure, but there are important caveats. The January issue of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter covers that and many other topics. Joining us now by phone is chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter, Dr. John Swartzberg. Welcome back, Dr. Swartzberg.
Thank you for having me.
What did the study say about organic foods? Thumbs up, thumbs down when it comes to cancer risk?
Right. It got a lot of headlines. This was a study published in JAMA Internal Medicine in October of 2018, and it looked at a very large population, almost 70,000 people, and they followed them over about 4.5 years, and they compared in that group those that ate organic fruits and vegetables versus those that did not. And they reported a 25% fewer cases of cancer in the group that ate organic fruits and vegetables. So that sounded, wow, like it's a no-brainer that that's what we should be eating. When we and others looked carefully at the data, though, the story isn't quite that convincing, and it's much more nuanced. It was an observational study, which means it couldn't prove causality. More importantly, the 25%, when you look at it carefully, what it translated to was that there were 6 fewer cases of cancer for every 1,000 people in the group that ate organic foods. So it was not dramatic. So 6 fewer in 10,000 people is not a big number. And only lymphomas and postmenopausal breast cancer were reduced. So that made us a little more skeptical about what the real answer is here. The other feature about the study that one has to realize is that in the group of people that eat organic fruits and vegetables, they tend to be more health conscious in general. So this is called the healthy eater phenomenon. And that is, are people who eat organic fruits and vegetables likely to be taking better care of themselves in other ways and therefore be at lower risk for cancer and other problems? I think those two things really raised our eyebrows a little bit in terms of how important the study was. There was another study that looked at women. It was called the Million Women Study in the United Kingdom. This was just a very few years ago. And they looked at something similar, and they didn't find any association between cancer and whether or not one ate organic foods. So what's the bottom line to all this? I think the bottom line is that we just don't know whether eating organic foods is a way of reducing your risk for cancer.
And getting back to when you said that it could be a correlation that people who buy organic foods tend to be healthier anyways, is that a function of income? I mean, people who buy organic foods tend to spend more on their foods, right?
Right. It may very well be a function of income, a function of education about health. It could be a function about things we don't even anticipate. But that's a pretty big issue in terms of people who have more money tend to have lower rates of many medical problems and lower death rates. So there's definitely a correlation there, and that may be the real factor in this. Mm-hmm. The important thing, I think, for anybody listening to our discussion right now is that the most important thing we do is we eat lots of fruits and vegetables. We know those are healthy. Whether or not those fruits and vegetables should be organic or not is, as I said, open for debate.
Mm-hmm. Lectins. The question about lectins, the question is, are they the new gluten? Is it something else to avoid? Tell us what lectins are and what research is telling us about what they do.
Right. Well, lectins are a group of what we call carbohydrate-binding proteins. And they're on lots of different foods. They're especially high in legumes and wheat, but they're in lots of different foods. And they're there primarily for the plant to protect themselves from other animals eating it. The interesting thing about lectins is that there's no data to support the contention that they're toxic to us. In spite of that, there has been a, more recently, a very popular book of a doctor promoting lectins as the new great toxin. There was a book several decades ago that also promoted this idea. But neither of those books are based upon any science at all. And they're really based upon, at least the latter one is based upon selling some other products that that doctor is selling to protect you from the damages that ostensibly lectins might cause. In any case, we looked at it really carefully and looked at the claims about lectins. And I'm happy to go through each of those with you, but the bottom line to that is that none of those claims have any substantive science behind them.
Well, one thing, lectins promote weight gain. That would right away be a red flag to a lot of people. Where did that come from?
I have no idea where that came from. What's so interesting about that is that study after study after study, looking at ways that people can lose weight and maintain weight loss, suggests a diet that's high in plant-based foods. That's the bottom line. So mm-hmm. the idea that lectins, which are plant-based foods, are high in lectins, would promote weight gain is absolute nonsense. Tucked into that is a little bit of a truth, and that is that anytime you want to lose weight and you exclude any particular food from your diet, you will lose weight because you're going to reduce your caloric consumption. So if you stopped eating plant-based foods, didn't eat anything that was plant-based, you would be changing your diet, you'd probably be consuming fewer calories, and you'd lose some weight temporarily. But that's the only connection between that claim of weight gain and eating plant-based foods.
And the idea that lectins cause cancer, you're saying that's absolutely ridiculous as well.
Well, it's for the same basis. Mm-hmm. When we look at studies about populations and what kind of foods they consume, we know that people who have a diet that's high in plant-based foods have a lower incidence of certain cancers. That's really well established in the literature over several decades. There's no evidence that we could find, absolutely none, that suggests that eating lectins would have a propensity to cause cancer.
And then that they cause inflammation and inflammatory diseases. Anything? Is there a nugget of truth in that can explain where this comes from, this opinion?
Yeah, well, it is an opinion, and it's not based upon any science we could find at all. As a matter of fact, we found that I'm going to backtrack on that and say that there is some data in animals, in laboratory animals, that it increased inflammation. That said, every study that we could find in human beings that consumed lectins, our foods that were high in lectins, showed a decrease in inflammatory markers. And inflammatory markers may be important because they could be a signal for people more at risk for some autoimmune diseases and coronary artery disease. So in human data, there's absolutely no evidence that lectins would cause inflammation. And as a matter of fact, there's good evidence that they probably reduce it.
You spend a lot of ink on disputing. It must be something that's running around that you're concerned about, that people are getting the wrong impression then.
We are. It's books get popularized. The internet certainly fans those flames, and people with titles like MD mm-hmm. can make outstanding claims that are not based upon any science and that are very self-serving. As I mentioned earlier, the most recent book that was about this, the doctor also on his website sells a variety of products to compensate for the lack of fruits and vegetables in your diet. So very self-serving, not based upon science. And what we try to do with our newsletter is really look at the science behind a lot of claims.
Dr. John Swartzberg is my guest. He's chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley Public Health Wellness Newsletter. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. I'm sorry, the Public Health Wellness Letter. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. High blood pressure was the big headline in the January edition, and what to do when high blood pressure won't budge. There's a name for that. It's called resistant hypertension. What causes it?
Well, we don't know what causes it. We know that certain groups of people are at greater risk for this. But before I go into that, let me just quickly define what we mean by resistant hypertension. Mm-hmm. It means that if you've got high blood pressure and you're on three or more drugs and that's not controlling your blood pressure, or if it's controlled but it requires four different drugs to control it, that would fall into the category of what we call resistant hypertension, or just think of it as high blood pressure that's really hard to treat. We know that African Americans, people who are older, and men seem to be at more risk for this than other populations. The reason why it's important is because people with this resistant hypertension are at greater risk for the complications of high blood pressure, like stroke, kidney disease, heart attack. But here's what's interesting. People who are really resistant to treatment are a very small group, because many people who think they're resistant to it really are poor adherers to the prescribed drug regimen.
How so?
Well, and this astounded us when we looked at the data, but somewhere between 50 and 80% of people who need blood pressure lowering medications don't take them as directed. I'm going to repeat that. Somewhere between 50 and 80% of people who are told, take this blood pressure medicine, they don't either take it or they don't take it as prescribed.
Mm, that's crazy.
It's very upsetting, because we know the risks of high blood pressure. And we know if you take medication for it, that is, if you can't control it with diet and exercise and low salt consumption. But if you take medication for it, it'll reduce your risks for those complications. And who wants to have a stroke or a heart attack or kidney failure? Another interesting thing we found is that one in four patients prescribed high blood pressure pills never fills the initial prescription.
Hmm.
25% of people whose doctors tell them, here, you need to take this medication, they don't fill it. So I think that we could focus on that very small group of people who just don't respond to medications. But the biggest problem in that group is that people either aren't taking their medicines or they don't take them as prescribed.
Well, what do we know why?
Well, we don't know precisely why, but there are a variety of reasons that seem very likely. One of them is cost. And that's an enormous problem, as I think most people are aware of now. Prescription drugs are expensive.
Right.
Another one is denial. That is, blood pressure is a silent disease. You don't feel it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't. People think if they have a headache, it must be their blood pressure. But we don't feel high blood pressure unless it's dangerously high. So it's a silent problem. And so who wants to take a pill that might have side effects to treat something that's a, quote, silent problem? A third problem is that people are often given medications and they don't want to take pills, but they don't entertain making lifestyle changes like losing weight, reducing the salt in their diet, reducing alcohol consumption. All those things have a major role.
Do you think, and we're just about out of time, Dr. Swartzberg, but do you think that physicians don't take enough time to explain to their patients why it's important?
That's I'll try and give you a pithy answer. And
yeah.
I think that a lot of doctors do take the time. I think a lot of doctors are too pressed for time and
yeah.
they just write a script and tell the patient to take this without explanation. That may be where patients need to utilize their pharmacist mm-hmm. to give them more information.
All right. Well, Dr. John Swartzberg, thanks so much for your time. As usual, I always appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Dr. John Swartzberg. He's chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. And that's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.